Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of the world's best resource for hockey strength and conditioning information. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com.
Hey guys, my name is Brian Sipitz. Thank you for joining me on the Hockey Strength Podcast. This is episode 58, and today we're joined by a very special guest. He's one of the top educators in the field right now, one of the best coaches around. He's been at the NCAA, the NHL, and the Major League Baseball level. Coach Mike Boyle is joining us from Boston today. We're going to be talking about on-ice conditioning as we get started with the season here. We see a lot of things going wrong, especially in preseason with injuries and all that. So we want to talk about the best way to get players in shape, getting back on the ice here in August and September. So we start off with that, and then, of course, if Coach Boyle's going to talk, we're definitely going to listen. We sort of end up wandering around a little bit, but talking a lot about athletics and athletics in general and development in general. So stick with us to the end. We cover a couple different topics, and as always, lots of great stuff from Coach Boyle. So, of course, we are the official podcast of HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. You can check us out for just $1 for the first 7 days. There's articles, programs, webinars. Of course, the podcast is always free, but check us out. If you train hockey players, if you are parenting a hockey player, if you're coaching hockey players, lots of great information for everybody. Also, check out our Twitter feed at Hockey Strength and our Facebook feed as well, which is the same at Hockey Strength. So, all that stuff aside, let's go ahead and get started with Coach Mike Boyle. All right, guys, thanks for tuning in to episode 58 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Today, we have a guest who, surprisingly, we have never had before on the podcast, especially given that he actually started this website, HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. At least, I guess maybe it was Anthony's idea. Coach Boyle, is that right? Anthony's idea? Maybe you jumped on board with him?
I'm trying to remember. I think it was more Sean and Mike Potenza actually initially.
They were driving.
Do this. And to be truthful, I should have a better memory for all this stuff than I do, but I'm pleading old age to everything now, so that's my excuse.
All right. Well, we might have to clear things up with Anthony Renna because he says it was his idea and he should get it going. So anyway, that's a discussion for another time. But so we're getting close to the season here, and I know things are starting to wrap up at your place for the summer. Maybe a couple weeks left in your training programs. Is that right?
Yes, we've basically got, I said 1 week, we've got some girls that are going down into Olympic residency, some girls that are going back to college, and then we've got our pro guys who have 2 more weeks, you know, with us sort of exclusively, and then they'll start doing some on-ice stuff. There'll be a little bit more of a shift towards the on-ice and a little bit away from what we're doing. So a couple weeks.
Okay, cool. And that actually leads in nicely to what we're going to talk about here today. And I thought with the season coming up, it would be good to talk about on-ice conditioning and maybe how that should be implemented if the strength coach can have a say in things. And I think from year to year, you just see coaches that get super excited to have their team back on the ice, and they want to get them in game shape as quick as possible. And a lot of times, you know, what we see is they put the gas pedal down right away and you know, come up with some groin strains and some injuries right in the beginning of the season. So let's talk a little bit about things that you've found to be useful or things that you've found that have worked in terms of implementing on-ice conditioning as you get closer to the season and then, you know, in a training camp situation.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I guess we've probably got two types of audiences here, I think, or maybe even three. You've probably got guys who are working at the Division I level and can have some input into what their teams are doing for conditioning. You've got guys probably at the Division II, III level who are going to have to do it themselves. And then you've got the average youth hockey coach who's totally on their own. And the reality is, I think I would say everybody's situation is really different and everybody's situation is really the same. And one thing I say all the time is resist the urge to coach. Because as you said, I think sometimes people just, okay, I want to ramp it up. I want to get going. I want to make it hard. And then we get into the whole kind of mental toughness thing and stops and starts and up and backs and all this, you know, board to board. And people get hurt. And then people get frustrated because people get hurt. And then it's really frustrating if you happen to lose somebody who's really valuable to your team or you get somebody now who has one of these sort of sports hernias or recurrent hip problems that are almost directly related to, I think, poor progression and not paying enough attention to what's actually going on. So I think there's a whole bunch of variables that we have to look at when we start thinking about on-ice conditioning. One of the things that we did is that we didn't do very much on-ice conditioning at the beginning of the year. And we did a lot of off-ice conditioning, but that's, I think that's a luxury. That's the Division I guy's luxury. So for us, we had Airdyne bikes, we had a polar heart rate system, and we would do very, very brief skates. So our guys at the college level were allowed to go on the ice on their own and play around, play shinny, scrimmage, whatever you want to call it at your school. When that was done, we would take about a 15-minute block of time, and we would do some short sprinting, basically some goal line to blue line sprints. And then we would skate laps. We had a Finnish coach, Pertti Hassanen, who was with us for a long time in the 90s, who was really big on laps and on interval training via laps. And it's something that we started doing, like I said, in the early 90s. And I stayed with it the whole time I was at BU right up till 2012. And we would just do an interval program like what you'd see somebody do on the track, where we just would be switching laps clockwise, counterclockwise. But it might be something as simple as 6 times 1 lap, done at kind of a 15:45 sort of a pace, or a 15:30 pace. And we'd set the guys up into 4 groups and put them in 4 corners of the ice so that everybody was starting from a different spot, so we weren't running into each other. And everybody knew which way they were going, and we did everything on the whistle. But it was legitimately about 6 minutes of skating to start with. And we would only add about a minute every day. So, and really, it was 3 days of the week we did this. So we only probably added 2 minutes a week, and maybe over the course of 3 or 4 weeks of preseason, we might get from 6 minutes up to 12 minutes. And obviously, it's not 12 minutes of continuous. 6 minutes of skating, if you're thinking 15 seconds on, 45 seconds off, you're doing one every minute. 6 minutes, 6 laps really means that you've gone a minute 30 seconds of skating. And some people might be like, how the heck are you going to get in shape with a minute 30 seconds of skating? Trust me, you can get in shape with a minute 30 seconds of skating. What we would also do is we would then go in and bike, and we would push really hard on the bike. We would do – this is where we did more Tabata-type stuff, 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off on our either Airdynes. Now we're using assaults. But we would do that afterwards, because I always feel like metabolically you can really – work somebody hard metabolically with a bike without worrying about groins and hips and all these things going wrong. So my feeling was the ice is going to be easy, the bike stuff is going to be hard. And we would generally be very healthy through preseason, and really very healthy through the season, because we would follow this kind of format.
So when do you consider preseason? When does that start for you? I mean, given that guys are on the ice most of the summer.
So we started preseason sometimes in August. In terms of whenever school started, whenever we could have our entire team report, that was when preseason started, and we would get the guys on the ice. As soon as the NCAA said we could be on the ice, we were on the ice. And there's a really good quote that I pulled up, and it's pretty interesting. I used it in my complete conditioning presentation, but it's a Dan Baker quote, and it says, "It must be remembered that for field sport athletes, practical observation has shown that most of the skill and tactical training undertaken are at long, slow distance types of speeds and heart rates. Thus, given that skill and tactical training with the sports coach is the major form of training performed by field sport athletes for most of the season, this training involves cardiovascular stimulation on the lower end of the polarity spectrum. The role of the strength and conditioning coach is to provide a high-intensity stimulus to improve aerobic fitness." And I think you can look at – I would look at hockey as falling in that field sport realm in terms of the bioenergetics of the game is going to be fairly similar to – not the same, but similar to lacrosse or hockey or basketball, in the sense that it's going to be very stop and start. Hockey, I always feel like, is more unique, because we're the only sport where the person regularly exits the playing surface and then comes back on, which makes, in my mind, an even greater case for more interval type stuff and no need for any steady state stuff at all. And what Dan's quote did, though, for me, and Dan's a rugby guy, actually, but it just reinforced that idea that people are always worried about, because, again, I always say Joel Jameson sort of has become the newest conditioning guru, and I think Joel's stuff is great, but people are always worried about, oh, we're not getting enough cardiac output work, and what I felt like is we get tons of cardio. You know, we have, when we scrimmage and we play shinny and we do all this stuff, we put heart rate monitors on somebody, we're getting plenty of work in that low to mid range. But what we don't get enough of is the high end. What we have to figure out in hockey is how to give these guys the high end without hurting them, which I think is where the difficulty really lies.
True. And I think that's where you see a lot of your preparation with the summer conditioning program coming into play, with a lot of stride board work, where it's not like you're just introducing them back to the ice. And it's not as if they've been off the ice all summer anyway. I only know a handful of guys that are off the ice right now.
Right. And you could probably attest to this more because obviously you've played in the not so distant past. When I started out doing this in the 90s, people that skated in the summer skated one night a week in a men's league. And it was kind of an excuse to go out with their buddies and have a couple of beers. They'd play one game, and who knows what it was, you know, 220s or something. I have no idea what they played for time because I never really paid attention. But no one skated. No one power skated. Our situation now, our pros, college kids, and elite-level high school kids are on the ice somewhere between 3 and 5 hours a week right now. So we've found that with the kids that we know are on the ice, we've gotten away from slide board work. We're doing less running. We're doing more biking. Whereas in the past, I would be almost the polar opposite of that, thinking, okay, guys aren't skating. So that's why I said there's a lot of variables here that you have to look at. You've got to – I always like to say too, I use a slide in my presentations that says know your audience. I think you need to know your audience and realize, okay, what do I have in terms of – do I have Division III kids who haven't skated at all? Do I have high school kids who are playing multiple sports? Who do I have, and then how much skating have they done? And then I keep going back to that idea, resist the urge to coach, resist the urge to be like – to, you know, to pull out the whistle and play Herb Brooks in Miracle, you know, again, again, again. And because guys blow this thing up on themselves, and then they sit there and wonder, what happened? I don't know what happened. And I look at it and think, I know what happened. You didn't know your audience. You didn't look at this. You didn't think about the level of preparation. You didn't think about the increase in time and volume and distance in terms of what you're doing during the course of your preseason period, and then you get guys hurt. So one of the things, as I said, we were very, very careful. If we looked, our preseason skating program was laid out, and we knew exactly how many laps we were going to do, how much time we were going to be skating for. Our bike program was laid out. We knew exactly how many intervals we were going to do and exactly how many. And I was always really conscious. Years ago, Vern Gambetti used to always talk about the 10% rule. If you don't do more than 10% more, you'll probably never get anybody hurt. And I sort of amended that as that I went on to, it might be 20%, but 20% was a pretty safe area to stay in terms of saying, okay, when I'm looking at the total volume of work that I've done, particularly the total volume of high-intensity work, that can't go up more than 20% from, say, day to day or from week to week. Or more than likely, I'm going to start getting some problems, some pulls, some pains, so too many guys in the training room, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, again, it looks a lot like the summer training program, the off-ice training program. And then when you do get on the ice, I know there are on-ice tests, so like training camp tests or, you know, conditioning tests that are done on the ice. But you have your players, or you have the players on the ice for a significant amount of time before that test, right? That's not the first thing you do when you get on the ice?
Right. It's not the first thing that we do, no. And with us, I think, and I'd have to go back and look at my schedule, but I want to say we did our on-ice testing about week 3 of our preseason program, so that we gave them some time to adapt. And we developed a great on-ice test that lots more people are using now. We basically just kind of bastardized the 300 shuttle to make it an on-ice test. And all I really did when I first did it was figured out, okay, goal line and blue line, because one of the things, and this is where hockey is difficult, rinks aren't standard. Mm-hmm. So when you start trying to develop a standardized test, it's really difficult because it's not like a football field or something where you can say this line to this line is this far. The only consistent distance in a hockey rink is the offensive zone. And so by realizing that, that fact, we said, okay, the test has to be done in the offensive zone. So for us, the test was blue line to goal line 7 times because that was what came in at about a minute. The interesting thing about it was it correlated almost perfectly with our 300-yard shuttle run test in terms of the players that did well in the 300 shuttle also did well in the on-ice shuttle test. And surprisingly enough, I never thought about it. When we figured out the distance, it was very close to 300 yards again. And it was very accidental, but it worked out that way. The times were very, very similar. So we were able to look at average time and differential in the same way that we used to look at the old 300-yard shuttle run. But I think for hockey guys, one of the things, and I agreed with them, guys would always look and think, why can't we test on the ice? We skate. We don't run. And I think a lot of us, because most of us as strength and conditioning coaches came from non-hockey backgrounds, I think initially we fought that. Then when we first started to look at it, people had all kinds of weird tests, S-tests, starting behind the net, do this, go around a cone. And there was no way to standardize any of that stuff. So as I think the science-y side of me said, this stuff's bullshit. It's a total waste of time. And it really just tests skating ability. And I wanted something that didn't really test skating ability as much as it tested condition. And the more kind of S-curves you make, the more you let somebody corner, the more it favors the guy who's a good skater.
Right.
When you stopping and starting, when you say, no, we're just going to go goal line, blue line, that really favors the kid who's stronger. And it most favors the kid who's the most highly favored kid is the guy with the best combination of strength and conditioning. And that was what I wanted. So I wanted to see that guy. Who's the guy that can stop and start and keep going? Because some guys, I mean, if you've done the test yourself, and I don't know if you've done it with your guys, but guys get rubber-legged on that second one like nobody's business. It's amazing to see really good skaters who can't move their legs by the midway point of that second interval. And the one thing that we realized, and we did it, I started doing it with our BU guys, and I started doing it with our Olympic women's program. And I hate to say it because I think it makes me come off like the people I say I don't want to come off like, but when you're not ready, it's embarrassing. And I don't mind somebody getting embarrassed when they're not conditioned. What I've said to them, so one thing I like to say to people, okay, here's the test, here's the date, I expect you to be ready. And when someone shows up and can't do it, I have no sympathy whatsoever. Zero. Because I feel like I told you when, and I told you how. There was no surprise here. You should have been ready. And I couldn't, you know, even with BU guys initially the first time with some of our Olympic girls, people said things like, oh, I thought it would be easier. And I looked at it and said, I sent you out a program that's because one of the things that we do is like we did gold to blue line times seven. We'd start out with four. So we do gold to blue line times four, take like a 3-minute rest, do gold to blue line times four again. So somebody got a feel for, okay, this is what it's going to feel like. And then we did five, then we did six. And then come test day, we did seven. So everybody had a little sense of it, or should have, because that went out in the mail to everybody and said, hey, here's the best way to prep for this test. And then people would come in and you could see who your preparers were. And those are the people that I wanted. Those are the people that I wanted around. Those are the people that I wanted to build around. And those are the people that I said to the coaches. And so we would make it really tough on somebody who didn't do what we asked them to do, because one of the great things at BU with Coach Parker was we got to be really close, obviously, because we were together for a really long time. And he started to really understand my feeling was that the way that we prepare is going to be the way that we play, the same way you would feel in a game situation. I felt in a strength and conditioning situation. So I would never buy in. It used to drive me crazy when people would say, well, I got my best player, he doesn't like to lift weights. And I'd be like, who gives a shit what he likes? he may not like good food. He may not. There's a lot of things he may not like. That's not an option. But I knew college coaches who said, yeah, I don't make so-and-so lift. And I'm like, the rest of the team lifts and your best player doesn't lift? Yeah, he feels like it slows him down. He feels like it makes him feel a little uncomfortable. And I can't believe that coaches – I used to look at – you know, Coach Parker was great. I always say to Coach Parker, would we ever do that in practice? If he ever said, like, I don't like to – you know, I don't like to do the skating at the end of practice because it makes my legs tired. And, of course, every coach gives it. Of course not. We never let him do that. It's like, okay. Same situation. There's got to be one set of rules. And we were great in terms of Coach Parker. I mean, we made Keith Kachuk do it. We made Tony Amonte do it. We made Sean McGeckin do it. We made Mike Sullivan do it. And Mike Sullivan became one of our biggest proponents. You know, he's won two Stanley Cups. But these were guys that bought in. And when the young guys came in and didn't buy in, hey, it's like Coach Parker, like, hey, it's really, here's the door. no problem. You know, you don't want any part of this. We don't need you. And nobody ever left. And we won a lot of games. And we won close to 30 games a year for 20 years. When you start looking at the number of wins.
Well, you know, I think that's kind of sort of the success that Devin's having at UMass Lowell and you know, places like Quinnipiac, where they're getting, you know, the older players and maybe the players that are willing to do that conditioning and willing to grind it out. They have their kind of their own special brand of hockey there. So they're winning games too.
Can you say that? Because if you look at who the final four teams and the final eight teams have been, and I don't say this to toot my own horn. I say it because it is factual. Devin McConnell interned at BU. Rajesh interned at BU. Danny Gableman interned at BU. Matt Shaw interned at BU. Rick Blackadar interviewed at BU. And that's Providence, Quinnipiac, Denver, Union, and Lowell.
Yep.
And if you look at your final eight teams the last 4 or 5 years, those guys were there over and over and over again. So I think it is – I think guys saw what we were able to do from a culture standpoint by just saying, hey, here's what – and the good thing was it was really well thought out culture. There was no – we never beat anybody up, no whatever. I mean, guys would say – it's funny. Our young Canadian kids would come in and first preseason workout, they'd say, this is the hardest thing we've ever done. And I would look at them and say, you're only going to say that 30 more times before the season starts, because every day will be the hardest thing you've ever done, because every day will be a little harder than the day before. None of them will be significant. None of them will be like, oh, my God, that was the worst one ever. But every day will be a little harder. And the result was a good adaptation. If you look, Quinnipiac's put a bunch of guys in the NHL. Devin's put a boatload of guys in the NHL in the last 5 years. They had two guys winning Stanley Cups. So Quinnipiac, or Union, all these teams, because it's – the good thing is, as strength and conditioning coaches, if we do our job, we can have a massive impact on kids and on teams.
Yeah, and I think the system lends itself to that too, because like you said, it's just that steady increase of demand, and that's it. You know, it's not like – killer days and non-killer days. You know what to expect. You know what you're getting into. And it's something you can kind of commit to over the long haul.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I spent 2 years in Major League Baseball in 2012 and 2013. And one of the observations in baseball is that there's no room for grinders. You can either hit or you can pitch or you don't play. And there's none of this, oh, yeah, this guy, he's going to work really, really hard and he's going to bunt and he's going to get hit by pitches and he's going to do all these things and he's going to stay on the roster. Just doesn't happen in baseball. You can't. And the margin of error is so small. I always said if you hit the ball 2 times out of 10, you're a minor league guy. If you hit the ball 3 times out of 10, you're in the All-Star game. And hockey is much more intriguing in the sense that you really can. And that's why you said these teams like Lowell or Quinnipiac that are getting older guys, you can outwork other teams, particularly – and when your work is really intelligently done, it makes a massive difference. And I think that's the biggest thing that people are maybe starting to see now is that it's a process. It's a very well thought out process that – and the one thing, and I'll be honest, it works from the head coach down. If you get in and that's, you know, Norm Basin at Lowell and, Rick Bennett, and there's just all these guys that are out there that have done a good job. Quinnipiac coach, who I think they let you do your job, support you doing your job as a strength and conditioning coach, and that makes a massive difference.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, we're seeing it more and more, and I think college, in the college environment, I know you're not in a bubble, but compared to other situations, you have a lot of touches with the team, which is nice, and you know everything else that's going on. Let's talk about one more thing here and, put on the hat of a young strength coach who's working with a guy at like a hockey training facility. So just a coach that has a bunch of hockey athletes that, and especially like around the Detroit area here, and I'm sure in the Boston area too, there's so many opportunities to skate. There's so many camps, there's so many development programs during the summer. that you're not always going to have control of that or even have an idea of what they're doing unless you're asking them. So what can we as, you know, young strength coaches who have younger athletes, who have maybe high school age athletes, what can we do if, you know, if coaches come to us or if we know that there's some things going on with other teams that are, you know, it's the guys are just getting blasted on the ice every time they go on and that kind of stuff. What can we as young strength coaches do to talk with them?
Well, I think it's interesting. One of the things, I just sent somebody my Filling Buckets article. And I think that's one of the big things is I love this idea. And I wrote an article, I don't know if you've read it, but I wrote an article years ago based on a kid's book called Are You a Bucket Filler? Have You Filled a Bucket Today? I think his name did actually.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it's a children's book talking about the idea that when you say nice things to one of your peers, you fill their bucket. When you say bad things to one of your peers, you dip their bucket. So the teachers would use the analogy of, oh, Brian, that wasn't very nice. You dipped Mike's bucket. And I moved that analogy into the sports performance world and said basically that we've got to look for the full buckets and the empty buckets and realize that our job is to fill the empty buckets and that our job is not to fill the full bucket. And I think sometimes want to fill the full bucket because that's what we like to do. So instead, we are, you know, lumping more conditioning on a kid and asking a kid to do more than he needs to do and realizing that maybe his strength and power and speed bucket is relatively empty. I think those of us who are doing a good job in strength and conditioning know that anyway. But I think that's the biggest thing is looking and realizing, okay, today, and I do this all the time with my athletes, okay, well, we won't condition today because it was really, you know, you guys had a really tough day on the ice or that went longer than you thought or that was a harder workout than you thought. And I think I used to look at that and think that that was me being soft and thinking, oh, man, I just got to hammer him anyway. But I don't think that that's intelligent. And I think the other part is you got to preach. You really do. You've got to be trying to educate. You've got to realize that you have a requirement with coaches to educate and to explain to them that this may not be the way to get the job done and that, hey, look at our injury rate. Look at what's going on here. Like I see some of these college programs that have multiple hip surgeries during the course of a year or in the course of an offseason, and I think, what are they doing? How can that possibly happen? I could think of at BU, we did not even average – I don't think we averaged one every 3 years. I can think of two kids off the top of my head in the last – maybe 6 years that I was at BU who had hip surgeries. And so maybe, you know, even if actually I can think of a third. So maybe one every 2 years. And I see some of these programs that have two or three kids a year. Two doubles. You know, this kid had both sides done. And I think you're not being analytical. You're not looking at things and asking yourself. I think you always have to ask yourself the obvious question. If these things are happening, why are they happening? And then is there something that I can do to prevent that from happening? And those are hard questions.
So do you find now that, I mean, especially with the teams that are using, you know, GPS data or the accelerometers, I know you're using quite a bit of the heart rate data. Do you find that the heart rate data, you know, makes it easier to call whether, you know, maybe we won't condition today? Do you find that it's easier if you're noticing something going on with heart rates or especially if a team has the luxury of using the accelerometers, I think you get a better idea for actual training load.
Yeah. And I think,
but is that helping you?
Teams that can do that. I think the biggest difference in all honesty, and I've always said this is, hey, how you feeling? It's being there and being present, and much like any relationship. It's being there and being present and okay, how you doing? And being able to look, guys, I used to always say to somebody, what you need to do. So if I've got a team, I'm going to realize that my team is going to be represented as a bell curve. On one end of that bell curve will be the top 10 or 20% of my guys who will do anything that I ask them to do and will always think that we're not doing enough. On the bottom end of that curve will usually be my most talented players who will always think that we're working too hard and always think that we're doing too much and always will be asking, can we do less? I think you ignore both of those extremes and you focus your energy in the mid 60%, the guys that are on either side of that bump in the bell curve, and you talk to those guys and figure out how do they feel. As a guy who's a kind of middle of the road guy, not an obsessive compulsive crazy person who just wants to work harder and harder and harder, and not a dog on the other end. How does that guy feel? What is that guy's perception of the workout? And that's where some people obviously will use questionnaires and will look at things like that. And I was never a questionnaire guy. I was just more of a walk around. And it's kind of old. I think it was Peter Drucker called it management by walking around. And a lot of my management would be by walking around and looking at guys and talking to them. How do you feel? How sore are you? 1 to 10. What do you feel like? And then get a sense of, okay, this, you know, where, because again, what you realize is, I always used to say, you can't go backwards, but you can always go forwards. Like once you've hit that tipping point and you've gone past a certain point, it's very, very difficult to undo that, you know, to get the toothpaste back in the tube or whatever it is. But it's pretty easy to control the output. And so we would try very, very hard. And I think part of that is not as much as the data is planning days off. And even planning, I was talking about this today. I've got one of my young guys who's going to go out and work for Charlotte in the American League. And I said, you know, you've got to have a warm-up every day. Everybody's got to roll. Everybody's got to stretch. It's got to be mandatory. Because it's amazing. I talked to some NHL guys, and they say, yeah, our coaches don't want to make the warm-up mandatory. Now, that would make me freaking crazy. Like, I would literally probably quit if I was working for a coach. If I went into a coach that we have to have – everybody's got to roll. Everybody's got to stretch. Everybody's going up. Everybody's got to be there. If my head coach said, no, I'm not going to make the guys do that, I would be like, you know something? You know, you're making me do this job with one hand tied behind my back. I don't want to do it. I can't do it. I can't be effective if you can't support what I want to do. But there are guys that do it that way, that just say, yeah, the guys who want to warm up. The guys who don't want to warm up, don't. And I'm like, because what you realize and what we realized over the years is it ends up being exactly the polar opposite of what you wanted to have happen, in the sense that the guys that don't want to warm up are also the guys that get hurt, and they're also the guys that don't work hard. They're also the guys that will complain and point the finger at you later on saying that you didn't do your job. And vice versa, the guys, you know, the guys who are going to come in every day and warm up and roll and stretch and do everything you want are going to be the third and fourth line guys who aren't getting a lot of ice time. So you almost create or magnify the schism that's already in your team, in the sense that you've got guys who are already pissed off because so-and-so gets way more ice time with me. He's a dog. He doesn't work hard. He's just more talented than me. That's a frequent complaint in hockey, and it's a reality. We used to say all the time that talent and work ethic are inversely proportional, and our job as strength and conditioning coaches was to try to change that relationship. And that's not an easy thing to do.
Nope, especially not at the American League level, where you have some, you know, more veteran guys who have been in the NHL and now they're down and maybe they're a little sour about it, or, you know, whatever the situation is. There's always personalities to juggle, but yeah, I think that's a huge part is having that team warm up every time. It wasn't something that we had when I was playing, but would definitely be beneficial for that, for the groups that I had. So
yeah, I don't think, and it's funny, I don't think there's any question when I look at that stuff and think, it's such a simple thing to do, and it's not a hard ask. It's just, okay, here's, again, you wouldn't, and when I'd get into arguments with coaches, I said, so are we going to have an optional start of practice? You're going to say, like, practice will start at 10, but if the better guys want to get on at 10:10, that's going to be okay. And again, of course, you're like, so I always use sort of absurdity to help my case, because people would always look at me and think, of course we can't do that. Exactly. So why in my area are we letting it happen? When I'm saying to you that this needs to happen for us to be healthy, this needs to happen for us to keep our man games, loss, and injury down, why is it suddenly optional in an area that I think is really important? And the good thing, God, like I said, I was very lucky. I worked for one guy for a long time with Coach Parker. And the good thing about him, he had a really simple barometer. He'd look and say, will this help us win more games? I'd say, yep, I firmly believe it will help us win more games. Okay, then that's what we'll do. It was so easy. We almost never had an argument. We almost never had a disagreement. Because if he felt that I felt that this was going to help us win more games, then our guys were doing it. And anybody – I can still remember, we had a meeting probably in the early 90s. We had the only bad season we ever had where we were not above 500. And he walked into the room. He said, okay, he said, I'm going to make things really simple. He said, Mike Boyle's the head coach until October 1st. Treat him like he's the head coach. He said, anybody's got a problem, I'm going up to my office. Anybody wants to transfer, I'm going up to my office. I'll be there for the next hour. Anybody that wants to come in, we'll make plans for you to go someplace else. End of the meeting, he walked out. And the guys, all we had like 8 or 9 guys that were going to be on the Olympic team who were sitting there completely slack-jawed, like, whoa, I didn't expect that to happen. And I sat there and thought, I'm going to, you know, cause guys would give me a hard time. I'd look, I'd say, fine, go upstairs. He's waiting. You know, he says he'll be there. You can talk to him. You can go explain to him that you don't like the strength program, or you don't like lift weights, or you don't think you should ride the bike. And I can tell you that in whatever number of years I was there, it was probably about a 20-year period, 22 years. I don't think a guy ever went up. No one ever had the nerve to walk in the door and sit down and say, you know, I'm not ready to do the level of work that's required.
Nice. I love that. I love old stories like that. It's great.
I'll tell you, that's why he was so good. And I just sit our guys down. First meeting was always the same. How many guys will do anything to play in the NHL? Every hand goes up. I said, okay. I said, one, there's a bunch of liars in here, and I'll guarantee you that. I said, because I'm going to outline what I think everything is, and I'll guarantee you a bunch of you don't want to do it. And it was usually the freshmen, because the other kids had been in the meeting, you know, anywhere from 1 to 3 times prior to that.
Yeah.
But some of the freshmen, again, would sit there kind of slack-jawed, like, we got to get up for breakfast every day. You expect us to go to sleep at night? You expect us to not drink? I'm like, yep, that's what I expect. I said, if you're saying you'll do anything to be in the NHL, then here's what I think anything is. Control your alcohol intake. Control your food intake. Control your sleep. But I do believe that's why we had so many guys over that time period who ended up becoming NHL players, because guys, and again, the buy-in varies, but our guys pretty much bought into what we wanted them to do, and a lot of them became really good pros. And now, it's crazy. A lot of them are coaches. I said, you know, Mike Sullivan's a coach, head coach in the NHL. John Hines is a head coach in the NHL. Joe Sacco's an assistant coach in the NHL. Jay Pandolfo's an assistant coach in the NFL. Even of my summer guys, I've got 6 of my summer guys that are either general managers, assistant general managers, or directors of player development for teams. You know, Donnie Sweeney's general manager. Cam Neely's a president. Billy Guerin's an assistant general manager. Tommy Fitzgerald is an assistant general manager. You know what I mean? You go right down the line. Chris Clark is a player development director. Richard Park is a player development director. Chris Drury is an assistant general manager. I mean, you know, there's literally been so many of these guys because they did buy into what we wanted them to do. And then they realized how much it helped them in terms of the longevity of their careers. And now it's literally given them careers in terms of these guys that this is what they're doing the rest of their life.
Oh yeah, it's learning to manage yourself and make priorities and make big boy decisions when you get in college, and then you're set for those habits are set for the rest of your life. That's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Martin Rooney said one time we were talking, he said, there are professionals and there are people who get paid. And I said, that's a pretty good analogy. I like that. He said, there's a big difference between being professional and getting paid. There's a lot of guys getting paid to play hockey, but there's not a lot of guys that are real professionals. And you know it and you see it on teams. Like, hey, this guy's a real pro. This guy knows exactly what he's doing. I saw that even in baseball. So our best pitchers, our starters, most of those guys were professionals. They were very routine-oriented. They never missed workouts. They were never not doing what they were supposed to be doing. And it's a huge controllable variable, which is one of the things that you have to look at. People, again, you think about coaching and people always talk about control the controllables. Well, strength and conditioning and fitness and food, I mean, those are all controllables. Those are all things that you can exhibit a high degree of control over. And if you're not doing that, you're just not giving yourself the best chance to win.
For sure. So today we migrated from on-ice conditioning to a little bit of life lessons from Coach Mike Boyle, but always good to hear. And I think we better wrap up here. I think my data cuts off here pretty soon. But obviously, if we could talk for another hour, I would for sure.
Yeah, that I would want to add. Time speed. Time speed on the ice. Know who your fastest guys are. And then during the course of – we've been doing more time. And I've been reading some of Tony Hollis' stuff, who's a track coach. And if I was back in the hockey world, I'd be timing even more than I was timing before. I think I was one of the first people to ever time guys on the ice. We used the same distance, goal to blue line. And we could tell you not who looked the fastest, but who was the fastest. And I always use Nick Bonino as a great example. People always said Nick Bonino won't play in the NHL because he's not a good skater. And then we tested everybody. And Nick Bonino was middle of the pack. I remember going back to the coaches and saying, I don't know why you guys say Bonino's not a good skater. He said, he's not a good-looking skater. But that does not make him a bad skater. If you look at it, and I showed him the scores, I said, here, he's right in the middle of the pack. He's clearly not even, he's not even close to being our slowest guy. He's not close to being our slowest forward. And he just signed a huge contract and has been a really good NHL player. Got two cups, I think, the last 2 years. So,
yeah, us bigger guys, we never look super pretty, but usually we're going along okay.
Exactly. All right, well, that's my closing thought.
Well, hey, Coach, I really appreciate it. And good luck wrapping up the rest of the summer here and to your Olympic athletes and your NCAA guys that are headed off to school and to camp. And hopefully we'll be in touch soon.
All right, good luck with you guys, too. Keep up the good work.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for episode 58 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Thanks so much to Coach Boyle for joining us. He's definitely an influential guy, and there's a lot of wisdom there, too. So we could probably fill 20 episodes with just Coach Boyle. So anyway, thanks a lot, Coach, for joining us. My name is Brian Sipitz, and until next time, guys, be sure to train smart and check out hockeystrengthandconditioning.com, the world's greatest resource for training hockey players. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.